Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, not a handout, but a hand up. How one Catholic religious order is helping Africans help themselves in the field of healthcare. Cardinal Francis George of Chicago opens up his book on the difference God makes. And in part 16 in our series Vatican Centuries, we go back to the beginning of the second millennium. It's a continent full of challenges. Africa is a land just as brimful of hope. And the Africans themselves are the first to say they don't want a handout. They'd rather have a hand up, a boost to help them help themselves. As one of the leading health providers on the African continent, the Catholic Church is present in a myriad of hospitals, clinics, and medical facilities there, thanks to religious orders such as the Hospitaller Order of St. John of God, which besides providing health care, offers training programs for local medical professionals and staff. Well, here in Rome, Prior General of the Order, Donatus Forcan, tells Lydia O'Kane about the positive impact many of their institutions have had in Africa, beginning with their health facilities, most of which offer 250 beds each.
Each of them would have over 400 patients. So there's people on the floor because they've walked for miles. They come from other countries.
With various different illnesses.
Because of general hospital, malaria, what have you. I met a young mother and her daughter. Her daughter's about 15. This was in Togo. They had come from Nigeria to Togo because they had, there was a good hospital there. And I said, well, you've come a long way. Was it worth it? Oh, worth every mile. My daughter, she had the surgery and she's fine. She had a big smile on her face. But of course it means the hospitals are crowded and trying to keep them resourced financially, try to raise the level of care through education of the co-workers and the brothers. That's always a great challenge. And, you know, we say, well, you could open another hospital, but this, the same thing is going to happen. Of course, resources are limited. And the great concern now is that our benefactors, even though our experiences, no matter how difficult life becomes, a human being, I mean a family member, whoever, the charity they're supporting will be the last thing to go. And they don't want, most don't. So that usually the whatever donations come in, they keep coming. Even in the most, in Ireland we have a lot of fundraising. And during the hardest times, but our fundraising always kept an increase. Because people wanted, they felt, well, this is the last straw. As a human being, I want to help others. And if I have to stop this helping this charity, then it's like giving up on life. And they don't do that. And it's in our Irish culture not to do that anyway. And the same elsewhere, that people continue to support the charity. Whatever support they're given is pooled, and somebody at the other side of the world is getting the help they need. Preventing people from dying or getting surgery, getting what they need. I'm quite confident that even through this present crisis that the people will continue to support us.
It is difficult, though, isn't it, in times like these when people talk about recession.
And true.
Healthcare is such an important service.
It's only when you go to the developing countries and you see. I was visiting one of the hospitals, there was this baby. And the baby must be about maybe a year, but it looked about 6 months because it was undernourished, but looked reasonably healthy. And I put out my finger, and the baby grabbed my finger. And the doctor was showing me around. He said, when that child came in, he couldn't hold anything. He was so emaciated, was so weak, that you were afraid to touch him because that he might just fall apart, sort of collapse. And now he was a beautiful little baby, and as I said, grasped a hold of my hand. And I was afterwards talking to the co-workers and the brothers, and I was saying, well, you know, that's what it's all about. That's our mission. You know, it's life-giving. And so we have to keep on going, developing, expanding, improving our skills, learning more, trying to find resources, educating people to come earlier, having dispensaries in the villages so that people don't have to walk for hours. You know, this is the direction we have to look towards.
Education is vital, isn't it?
It's critical. It's absolutely critical for in all of our hospitals. Naturally, we have education for the parent, for the mother. Usually, the mother. It should be parents, but well, dad hopefully is working somewhere else. So education the mother how to in preparing food. Yeah, we have all preventative medicine, clean water, proper diet, and so far. And it doesn't. It's oftentimes lack of know-how. The materials out there, but so they teach them how to do that. And it is very effective. It is very effective. It's difficult to quantify because when people get well, they don't come back, and that's great. But it's an ongoing program that we have in all of our centres and services. And the Irish province has a model service in Malawi, which is incredible. It's a fantastic service. I feel very proud of it because I was associated with it from the beginning in helping to get going. But now it's an incredible service. It's a community-based mental health service. They have now built, they have a college, as you say, education is critical. So they have a college of mental health sciences where they teach for psychiatric nurses as a postgraduate course, for psychologists, for clinical officers in the area of mental health. That's only one part of the program, as well as the usual psychiatric program. Then they have a program for street children. There's no street children in Mizzou, so whatever, because immediately they're picked up and they're got even back into the family. They have a program going for them in the meantime, getting them education because they have dropped out of school. They're behind, so when they go back, they have special classes for them. When I was there, it was a young man from Dublin, from St. Andrews in Westland Row. And he was, himself and his wife were there. She was a physiotherapist and he was a teacher at the Christian Brothers School there. And he was doing a fantastic job. He was out for a year and a half running this program. And he had twinned this special class with St. Andrews in Westland Row. And they were exchanging paintings and all that type of thing. And then there was another group there who were doing taught traditional dancing, because the Africans love to dance. They're so good that the visitor from Dublin, that he was planning on bringing them to Dublin for the International Cultural Centre, and I'm sure that will be realised someday. So there's wonderful things, and then there's a one for growing a Food for Life programme, where you know we get terrible droughts in Africa, and particularly in that part. So the co-workers in Ireland started a day for Africa, and out of that they pay one day of their salaries for Africa. So from that one day and a few other events, they raised €250,000, and that's set up a program for growing maize, teach the people locally how to grow maize. We employed agricultural instruction and set up a system that it becomes self-financing. So that it doesn't have to put in money every year. Self-financing. Now they have 1,000 families. Can you imagine? 1,000 families, their family having 5 or 6 members. And that's self-financing. And they're selling food. They're producing it for the family. They're able to sell to buy books and stuff for the children. And they're able to save a little money, as well as pay back the loans. It's no handouts. You earn, you work. And of course, people are delighted to work. What makes work terrible is when there's nothing is for nothing. So this, and that has been copied in Sierra Leone. One of the brothers came and saw it, and it's supported by the fundraising one. But he has 700 families in Sierra Leone, and they're developing other aspects of it. That's what we're about, and really just generally that's our call, to be at the cutting edge. And to, because there's good people there, there's wonderful people, and all they're waiting for is to be asked to show how they can help.
Prior General of the Hospitaller Order of St. John of God, Donatus Forcan. Also here in Rome, Cardinal Francis George from Chicago, who presented his new book, The Difference God Makes, A Catholic Vision of Faith, Communion, and Culture. Well, Irene Lagan caught up with him and asked him what I suppose is the most obvious question. What difference does God make?
God makes all the difference in the world, and that's one of the two points that are difficult for people sometimes to understand. That when you talk about God, you talk about a relationship to everyone whom God loves, and so you have to think of the whole of the globe, of the church, of the world, and we tend to specialize and think about parts rather than the whole, and the church calls us, because of our relationship to God, to a deeper understanding of everything, because he makes a difference in everything, if he's the true God. And then because of that, he is also someone who calls us to relate to each other as brothers and sisters, rather than with the divisions of nation states and cultures and races that have so much been responsible for the violence in the world. And that's the second point, that it is relationships that identify us far more than our personal choices. And that, too, is difficult, especially in my own culture, where we think that we are self-made, in a sense, and forget that we were related before we came to any consciousness of who we are at all. And so we're related by our family and by the human family and by baptism to Christ, who is the Savior of the human family. So again, we're back to everything is related and integrated into the vision of God for the salvation of the world. And I try to work that out in various spheres of human experience and work out particularly a methodology of approaching the world and the church to establish these relationships in our self-consciousness, even when they're already there, and that is through dialogue.
The dialogue, says Cardinal George, must go on amongst ourselves, within the church, and with other Christians, with Jews and Muslims, as well as with secularists. Through dialogue, he says, we can form new relationships. And in helping Catholics to understand their role in the public square, Cardinal George says he hopes his book will encourage them to think beyond or behind politics.
Politics are defined by liberal and conservative, which is defined vis-a-vis the authority structures. And the Council called us to think about the church in the world. And from the unity of the church's own communion, we're to establish solidarity among all peoples in the world. That falls out of the usual liberal conservative categories that are political. And if we restrict our role in the world to those categories, then we're co-opted. We're either, you know, taken over as chaplains to the status quo, or else perhaps we'll suffer isolation. We have to get out of that political game, because church people don't play it too well very often, and remind the world of what the goal is of politics and every other form of human experience, and that is the unity in Christ of the whole world. So it's a constant pressure to move beyond the categories in which people habitually think, but which aren't broad enough to understand the love of God.
Does your book actually help people move out of those categories?
Well, there are methods of analysis, of cultural analysis, of political analysis. The goal, of course, is sanctity, communion with God. You know, we talk about the goal of universal communion among all of us. We talk about communion within the church, hierarchical communion. We talk about communion with God as the goal. So we keep that before people. But it's up to lay people in the world to determine how the transformation of the world is to take place. It's to the church to say, here's the goal, here's a method, dialogue, and here are the relationships that constitute who we are, whether we recognize it or not. But lay people have to really take that and create the social order.
Pope Benedict has spoken numerous times about the increased involvement for lay people. What are the challenges for the American church, and how can lay people become more involved?
But the challenge in particular for the church in the United States is to preach the gospel and to do that in the face of a rather entrenched individualist ideology that says we're a collection of individuals And the relationships are just added on as you like them, rather than to say you are, first of all, related, and that tells you who you are. So that kind of individualism as ideology is something that's a real challenge to the gospel and to the mission of the church. And lay people can confront that, if you like, by forming good families. The family is a school of love where we first learn that we're not the most important people in the universe. Somebody else must come first, our wife, our husband, our children. And when the family life is strong, then lay people will see how they can change the world as a leaven, transforming the world so that it is a place of love and therefore of justice and of peace. Again, the mechanisms for doing that are in the hands of lay people, the way to do it. But the goal is ours, and also, the methodologies, but most of all, the natural community, which is the family, if that is safe, will be able to safeguard decent human societies, a humane society, better than we have now.
In the United States in particular, there's health care reform on the table. What are the elements of health care reform that the USCCB is calling for? And what are the challenges that this must overcome? Again, abortion, those kinds of questions.
Well, the USCCB is insisting on two things. Everybody should be cared for, and nobody should be killed. So we are for a healthcare scheme to be sure that nobody is left out. However that's to be done is not for us to decide. It can be through private insurers, provided it's universal. It can be done with government funding, at least in part. Those are technical questions that the bishops leave to the people elected to represent their citizens to decide. The point that cannot be overlooked, that will kill every possible scheme, is the public funding of abortion, which is against the law in almost all cases still in the United States, and we can't allow health care to be a vehicle, even though it's good in itself as a goal, universal health care, to be the vehicle for including killing as part of health care. Whether you're talking about abortion, whether you're talking about euthanasia, no matter what you're talking about, killing is not part of health care, and so it should be left out entirely. That's a hard battle that goes back and forth because the health care proposals are many right now. You have the House coming forth with his proposal, the Senate with another, and they keep changing. It's a moving target. So we just keep repeating the principles. We're engaged in conversation with all those writing the legislation and with the White House, and we hope that in the end we will have a system where everybody can be cared for, but nobody is killed.
Cardinal Francis George of Chicago talking there about his new book, The Difference That God Makes, A Catholic Vision of Faith, Community, and Culture.
È una passione giocosa, è un buon sentimento, è uno sguardo e un pensiero che non si riposa, è la vita che accade.
And now Jill Bevilacqua presents the next in her series on the history of the Catholic Church, Vatican Centuries.
Chapter 16, The New Millennium.
The millennium had come and gone, bringing with it neither the end of the world nor a new golden age.
Charlemagne's empire had disintegrated, together with his legend.
The papacy, too, was in a very insecure position.
Spiritually, because the Pope's primacy over the Church was contested by the Patriarch of Constantinople.
Temporally, because as yet there was no such thing as a pontifical or Vatican state.
And practically, because the election of a Pope was still carried out in a very haphazard manner. There were no rules of procedure, apart from the consent of clergy and people, which applied to the election of any bishop.
In theory, the emperor, invested with spiritual and temporal powers at his coronation, could claim to represent the clergy and people of Western Christendom. But he was rarely on the spot when a pope died, and in reality it was the local Roman nobility who remained the most important single force in deciding papal elections.
In 1054, the spiritual dilemma exploded finally in what is known as the Great Schism. It was the definitive break between the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Church.
As the 11th century opened, Christendom was in a sorry state. Simony and concubinage among the clergy were two of the major evils. But reform was already in the air. It began in the monasteries, with Cluny leading the way, and soon afterwards came the reforming synods.
It was at one of these, held in the Lateran from 1059 to 1061, that a decree of Nicholas II established the exclusive right of cardinals to elect a pope.
We, Pope Nicholas II, decree and establish that on the death of the pontiff of this Roman Universal Church, the cardinal bishops shall first confer with most diligent consideration, and then shall summon the cardinal clergy to join them, and afterwards the rest of the clergy and people shall give their assent to the new election. They shall elect someone from out of this Roman church if a suitable candidate be found. If not, he shall be chosen from another church. But if the perversity of evil and wicked men shall make it impossible to hold a pure, fair, and free election in the city, the cardinal bishops with the godly clergy and Catholic laymen, even though they be few, shall have the right and power to elect the pontiff of the apostolic see in any place which they shall consider most convenient. After an election has been clearly made, if the fierceness of war or the malignant endeavors of any man shall prevent him who is elected from being enthroned on the apostolic chair according to custom, the elected shall nevertheless have authority as pope to rule the Holy Roman Church and to dispose of its resources.
When we speak of the Vatican today, we don't only mean the place where the Pope lives. We include in our minds the whole administrative apparatus which surrounds the 20th century Pope.
In the Middle Ages, the Pope didn't live in the Vatican, but at the Lateran, and it was there that the councils and synods of the time were held. The Vatican was simply St. Peter's and the surrounding area, including the Saxon Borgo with its houses, workrooms, church and cemetery.
But although the medieval popes didn't live above St. Peter's, they used the great basilica for all the more important religious ceremonies and for the solemn coronation of emperors.
On the 26th of March, 1027, Pope John XIX crowned Conrad II, Holy Roman Emperor, in the presence of two kings, one of whom was Canute of England, who was in Rome on a penitential pilgrimage. Canute wrote a letter from the Eternal City to Archbishop Alfris, full, we are told, of tender devotion to the Prince of the Apostles.
What Canute didn't mention was that the ceremony was not yet over when a violent argument over precedence broke out between the Archbishops of Ravenna and Milan, developing into a street fight between the two factions. Another petty discussion followed, this time about an ox hide between a German and a Roman. The crowd became a mob. Blood was shed, and the final scene of the day saw the most notable Roman citizens, barefoot and trembling, standing in St. Peter's before the imperial throne, a naked sword dangling at their necks while they begged for mercy.
By the beginning of the 11th century, the peoples whom Christianity had brought into the main current of European civilization looked to Rome for spiritual leadership. Latin Christendom had gradually taken shape as a cultural and spiritual unity, and as this unity rested on a common devotion to St. Peter, it was natural that the peoples it comprised should look to the Pope as its head.
And in 1073 there came to the throne of Peter a man who had no doubts as to the supremacy of his position. A man whose pontificate is by general assent considered to be a turning point in the history of the medieval papacy. For with him came a new attitude, both to the place of the church in society and the place of the pope in the church. The man was Hildebrand.
The story goes that as the body of Alexander II was being carried through the streets of Rome for burial in St. John Lateran, there was a sudden stir in the crowd. A group of men caught hold of a monk who was following the procession, pushed him through the ranks of guards and prelates, and thrust him onto the papal chair, while the throng clamoured wildly, "Hildebrand for Pope!" He was carried in triumph to the church of St. Peter in Chains, where in that period elevation to the papacy traditionally took place. and as the cardinals read the decree of election, bishops and nobles joined the cheering people in their unanimous acclaim of the new pope.
Hildebrand was no stranger to the Vatican or to papal activity. He lived through 6 pontificates and was minister to 5 popes. He'd been chaplain to Gregory VI and followed him into exile in Germany in 1046. For some years afterwards, he lived as a Benedictine monk at Cluny, the most famous of the Reformed monasteries. But when Leo IX was elected, he brought Hildebrand with him to Rome. Because of his knowledge of local Roman conditions, the Pope put him in charge of the papal estates, to prevent them from being ransacked by the nobility and to restore the papacy's material resources.
At that time, Hildebrand was only a subdeacon, and as yet his influence was not felt. But bit by bit, the popes came more and more to depend on him. He was certainly responsible in large measure for Nicholas II's decree on papal elections, and by the time Alexander II came to the throne, he was the pope's closest collaborator. A combination of today's Secretary of State and Cardinal Chamberlain. The first pope, in fact, to have come from what we know today as the Curia.
Hildebrand's programme of action is contained in the document Dictatus Papae, which he formulated during the Easter Synod of 1076. There were 27 points. A modern historian comments that these statements imply nothing less than a total papal sovereignty in all the affairs of the Christian community. And it's a measure of the greatness of the man who caused the 6 statements to be brought together that not one, except perhaps the last, is an idle boast. The Dictatus Papae is to be found in the volume of Hildebrand's letters.
The Pope can be judged by no one.
The Roman Church has never erred and never will err till the end of time.
The Pope alone can revise his own judgments.
He alone can use the imperial insignia.
He can depose emperors.
He can absolve subjects from their allegiance.
All princes should kiss his feet.
An appeal to the papal court inhibits judgment by all inferior courts.
A duly ordained pope is undoubtedly made a saint by the merits of St. Peter.
It's only fair to Hildebrand to mention that the Dictatus Papae was entirely personal and never intended for publication.
Nevertheless, Hildebrand knew exactly where he was going. For 23 years he had served the popes, influenced their decisions, and become the proverbial grey eminence, the power behind the throne. Once in office, he set out to make the authority of the papacy supreme throughout Christendom.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.